If you happen to pass Davis Smith, the founder and CEO of Cotopaxi, on the streets of Ecuador, the Philippines, or more likely outside his headquarters in Salt Lake City, you'll probably find him wearing a t-shirt with two words on the front, do good. It happens to be his company's slogan. Pretty cool, right? But what does that mean, really? How does his rapidly growing company with a major global impact turn two words from a slogan into a mission to the way of doing business? Here's this week's Game Face exec, Davis Smith, the man on a mission to turn Cotopaxi's culture into the new capitalism. And I want to welcome Davis Smith to Game Face Execs. Davis, it's great to see you, and thanks for joining us on this podcast. I can't wait to talk about Cotopaxi and your career and your rise in industry. But first of all, once again, appreciate you being with us.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. I'm really looking forward to this.
You know, for our listeners, our viewers, Davis and I met not too long ago, and it was thanks to his brother. Trenton and I were actually sitting on an airplane together. This is when most people were taking airplane rides, and we were heading to Detroit, and we were a bit delayed getting into Detroit, and so we missed our connecting flight, and he and I were both going to the same place, as it turns out. And so Trenton and I shared a rental car, and for 2 hours, we were driving what seemed like the middle of the night in a rainstorm, and just had a great conversation. And he said, have you met my brother, Davis? And I said, no, I haven't. I know of your brother, Davis. And he said, well, I've got to introduce you to. And so he did. And when I got back to Salt Lake City, where Davis and his business are located, we got together, had a great visit. And so ever since then, we've stayed in touch. And so once again, I appreciate you joining me. Davis, your name and what you and your company are doing is becoming recognized not only throughout this country, but throughout the world for the good that you do. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But you went to school without the intent of becoming an entrepreneur. You quickly discovered that entrepreneurship maybe was the ticket to get you where you wanted to go. So I've got to ask you, why do you love entrepreneurship? One who never thought he'd get into it.
Yeah, Rob, you're right. I mean, it wasn't something, I know a lot of entrepreneurs that grew up, you know, selling cookies from the time they were like 4 years old on the streets. And like, they were just entrepreneurial from day one. And, you know, when I look back at my own childhood, like there are elements that I see, it's like, oh my gosh, yeah, that thing that I did, that was kind of entrepreneurial. But I never really thought about entrepreneurship when I was in college, even. It wasn't something that I talked about. I never remember telling someone, I'm going to go start my own business. It wasn't until the very end of my time at school that a mentor kind of pushed me in this direction, and I found that it satisfied all these passions that I had inside of me. And you know, one of my favorite quotes is by a man named Dieter Rupdorf, where he says the desire to create is one of the deepest yearnings of the human soul, and I've just found that to be true. I think every person has this desire to create, and for some it might be music, it might be art, it might be cooking. For me, it's creating business. It's having this an idea and a big vision for what you want to accomplish and how you can impact the world through that idea, and then going and executing on it. So it's been a very fun discovery. I feel really lucky that I discovered it as early in my career as I did.
Well, you mentioned that mentor that pushed you into entrepreneurship. As I recall, you've told me that you actually wanted to work for him, and he kind of stiff-armed you and said, no, Davis, you don't want to work for me. You want to go work for yourself. And so I think a lot of the listeners and viewers are people right now who are working for someone else. And for some, that's definitely what they are inclined to do. It's what they're built to do, right? To be support and to help someone else achieve their vision. If you're working, give us some advice if you're working for an entrepreneur right now. What do you think we, especially those of us in sales, what can we learn from our entrepreneur boss that might make us better?
Yeah, so there's a great TED Talk that I watched a number of years ago that talked about leadership. And it had... it showed this guy, the guy giving the talk showed a little video clip of a guy on a on the steep hill at like a concert or something. And the guy, everyone's sitting on the blankets kind of watching and listening. And this one guy gets up and he's just like dancing kind of crazy, flailing his arms around and kind of doing these weird moves. And pretty soon a second person goes up and stands next to him and starts doing the same kind of thing. And before you know it, the entire side of this hill is covered with people dancing like this guy, just kind of crazy and like just forgetting what anyone might think of them and what they might look like. And what this guy talks about is that the real leader here was the second person. It wasn't the first person. The first person had the vision and was not afraid to go start doing it. But until the second person joined, you know, there was no movement. The movement began when the second person joined. And so, you know, if you're a salesperson and you can go find that guy or that girl that's dancing on the hill that you're like, I believe in that. You can be the one that starts the movement. And an entrepreneur is worthless by themselves. They need a team around them. And so that's your job as a salesperson. And by the way, every company needs great salespeople. And every CEO and every entrepreneur, that's one of the skills that I think they need more than anything is to sell, to be able to persuade people, to influence people in the things that they're passionate about, to sell that vision for something bigger that people can join and be a part of.
You know, your philosophies, I think, as people get to know you better, they discover that they were really embedded in you as a young child. And as an adult, you've been able to tap those and perhaps discover those tendencies, those the way you look at the world. And then you've been able to essentially blossom and to make sure that, or ensure that those philosophies and ideas actually turn into good. I want to go back to your childhood, though, if I could. We're not going to Oprah Winfrey here and make you cry or anything, Davis, but a lot of people don't know that you were raised abroad and you were raised in South America. You have a large family. You're one of eight children. And then you lived abroad as well, even as an adult. So you've had unique experiences that most of the listeners and viewers, we just haven't had. Right? We may have lived abroad or traveled to some extent. But if there's one thing that living abroad, traveling abroad has taught you, one experience you've had, one observation that you've made that you wish others could acquire, what would that be?
Yeah. This one for me, this is a great question, Rob. And it's something that I've thought a lot about during my life. You know, when I moved to Latin America, I was 4 years old. So it's really my earliest memories are living in the developing world. And the first place that my family lived was in the Dominican Republic, which was a very, very poor country. It continues to be, but especially in the early 80s. And I remember seeing children that were my age, you know, 3, 4 years old, standing on the sides of the street, completely naked. And even at that age, I started to understand that my life was different and I didn't really understand why. But pretty quickly I started to learn that I was very privileged. I was very lucky in where I'd been born. I had done nothing to deserve this life that I had. My family was not wealthy by any means. I mean, a large family, kind of making ends meet every month and being pretty frugal. You know, I never had the cool brands and stuff as a kid. But I had opportunities that I knew other kids where I lived would never have. And simply because of where I was born, they were just as smart as me. They were hardworking. They had dreams and ambitions too. And so, you know, growing up in Latin America, I think that's the greatest gift that I received from my parents was developing a deep sense of empathy for other people and understanding that I had a responsibility, a duty to use my life to be of use to others. And so that was a passion that I've had from the time I can remember. And it's really what's driven me to use my life to build what I'm doing now with Cotopaxi.
I just have to ask you, some people know that I've spent some time in Japan, lived in Japan a couple of times in my life. And I got to tell you, I just absolutely love that country. And don't tell anybody I told you this, but I've said to Allison, my wife, a couple of times, it'd be so cool to retire in Japan. There's a romance about that country that I've just always been attracted to. If you could retire, when you retire, if you could pick one spot in the world, what would that be? Where would it be, Davis?
Good question. This one's a tricky one because I spent a lot of my adult life living abroad as well. Like this is, it's something that's really part of me. You know, I'd say increasingly, I'm living in Salt Lake now. I moved here from Brazil a few years ago to start Cotopaxi, and I've got some family here in the area, and I have loved it. Like there's something special about being close to family. And so there's a part of it that says, you know, I'd be right here. You know, I'd be in Salt Lake City where I have friends and family, because that's just so, so fun to have that so close. But then there's another part of me, like the spirit of adventure. It's like, I want to go spend some time in a new culture. And that'd be tough for me. There's probably a few places in Europe, like Italy, that I think I'd love. I don't know Italian, but I speak Spanish and Portuguese, which are similar enough. When I go to Italy, I maybe understand, 10 or 20% of what's being said. But I think without a whole lot of effort, I could probably learn the language. And that's probably a place that I'd be interested, at least for a short term.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Cotopaxi, because it's your brainchild. You're the founder of this well-established company. And one of the first things that someone will notice about Cotopaxi when they look into it, and certainly on your website and in other forums, is that you have this slogan, very simple, called Do Good. Can you describe what that means and how you came up with that particular slogan? What's behind it?
Yeah. So when I was living in Brazil, I was building my last business, and that was my second venture. And I'd really kind of been put on this path of entrepreneurship by this mentor that I mentioned earlier, that he had been a successful entrepreneur, had become a philanthropist, was making such a big difference in the world. I was so inspired by him, but he was encouraging me to go find my own path and to go learn the lessons that I'd learned as an entrepreneur, and that, you know, if I had some success as an entrepreneur, I'd have the resources and influence to be able to go make a difference. And so, you know, when I was in Brazil, I was thinking a lot about that. I was back in the developing world every single day, you know, as I drove to work or drove home, I'd be reminded of my childhood and, you know, what it was like to live in these places and see so many people with so little. And so I decided that it was time. It was time for me to go do something more meaningful. I wanted to go do something that could make a difference in the world. And there were a number of factors in my life that kind of pushed me in that direction, and where the timing just kind of aligned. But I knew I wanted to go do something that could make an influence. I thought about, you know, maybe I should start a nonprofit, and, you know, I wasn't sure what I should do. But then this idea came to me of like, what if I built a business, a brand that its purpose would inspire people and move people to do good with us, where I could have a much bigger impact than just me, myself doing something. It would be a movement. It would be a movement of rallying tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people around this idea of doing good. And the business itself could sustainably do good. You know, I wouldn't have to go, you know, when you have a nonprofit, you're kind of begging people for money all the time and support to go help you go have the impact you want to have. But with a business, I just had to create a great product and a great brand, and those products and that brand would then sustainably fund the global poverty alleviation, this thing that I wanted to go tackle. I wanted to be a part of solving. And so I knew when I started this business, I needed to do it a little different. I identified the outdoor industry as a space that I thought would work. There is a very large total addressable market. It was a space that I was passionate about. And I felt like people that had experienced the outdoors or adventure and travel had connected with something bigger than themselves, and that they would identify with this mission that we had. And so I wanted to embed this mission into everything that we did. I knew that just another backpack company, the world didn't need another backpack or jacket company. There's so many of them. We needed to represent something different. And so, I started looking at ways to embed that social mission into every aspect of the business and the brand and the culture. And one of our slogans is Do Good. It's, you know, I have a shirt that says Do Good. It's one of our better selling products, and people, you know, when you wear that shirt, people stop you in the street and say, I like that shirt. And, you know, it's something that resonates with people. It's simple. It's a simple message.
Well, why do you think it resonates with people, Davis? What is it about that, the simplicity of that message that seems to be universal?
Yeah. You know, isn't that what makes us unique as humans? Like, you know, and different from every other animal on this planet is this, the empathy that we feel for others, the desire that we have to help others and to do good. You know, I think, I remember as a kid, I was a Cub Scout, and I got this magazine called Boys Life. And my favorite part of this magazine was there would always be, every month there would be a little story about a scout that would be the hero. They would go, you know, save a sibling that was in an accident, or that would found a stranger and was able to help them. And as a scout, like, that was always my kind of my secret dream of, like, I want to be there to, like, help somebody when they're in need. And you know, I think it's something that resonates with all of us. You know, we all want to be the person that can help that old lady across the street, or that can pay it forward when we're in the grocery store line and we see someone, that a single mom that can't pay for the groceries. Like, we all aspire for that. We hear those stories and they touch us, they move us. And so I think that's what, it's just a common, no matter what language you speak, no matter what part of the world you come from, helping someone else always feels good and it always touches us.
Davis, in your life, have you ever been a victim of the old adage, no good deed goes unpunished, where you tried to do good, but you got burned, or it was misinterpreted, misunderstood? And I think we've all experienced that. If we've tried to do good in one time or another in our life, this has happened to us. What causes you, and maybe there's an incident you can share with us, maybe there isn't, but what causes you to keep doing good anyway?
Sure. I have, you know, with this business. So when I had the idea, I wanted to name the business. I wanted the name to mean something. I didn't want to just create a word, a made up word. And I chose the name Cotopaxi. It's the name of a volcano in Ecuador where I lived as a kid and as a teenager. The school I went to was called Academia Cotopaxi, named after this volcano. And I used to go backpacking there with my dad. It was the first place I saw llamas in the wild. It was just a magical place for me. This beautiful snow-capped volcano, right on the equator, but permanently snow-capped. It's so high, the elevation's so high, and just a beautiful place. And for me, it symbolized a lot of the things, you know, my childhood and these experiences that I had, my love for the outdoors and, you know, living in Ecuador, this connection that my parents were really good at helping us go out and serve. And I just had some experience that really moved me and that had stuck with me throughout my life. And so I chose this name. And, you know, a few years ago, it didn't happen in the first couple of years of the business, but it's happened a few times since, where I've had someone reach out that was Ecuadorian, and for the most part, I'd say predominantly anyone from Ecuador sees the name and just immediately is just like, love it. Like, especially when they learn about the mission and everything. But every once in a while, I've had this three times so far, and I'm sure there will be more, where an Ecuadorian, maybe an American, Ecuadorian American that's grown up here will say, hey, I was really excited about this, and I was expecting to see the founder was Ecuadorian, and then I saw it was a white guy, and it feels like you stole part of our country. You stole this name. And at first it felt hurtful, because it felt like that's part of who I am. I know I look this way, but like I grew up there. Like, that's who I am. Like, I've spent a lot of my adult life there. Like, that's home to me. And Ecuador is a part of me. And the whole reason I'm doing this is to give back. And we have all this impact that we're doing in Ecuador. And, you know, but they were, you know, pretty critical, and a couple of them very vocal, you know, online about it. And, you know, at first, like I said, it was really hurtful, but I tried to do a better job of listening and trying to understand their perspective and where they're coming from. And I've learned some things in that process. And I think there's some things that we've done better. We started investing more in that part of the world. Where we were originally kind of doing some more of our social impact work in Africa and India. And we've kind of shifted our focus towards this region of the world, which is great by me. It's where I grew up. It's it's a place I'm passionate about. But it felt, in listening to them, it felt like that would be a better way to do this, where it's like, if I'm using this name, I should be supporting the people of this country and that region more. And so, but yeah, there were some painful moments, in listening and learning.
Well, you've really kind of established a baseline of corporate social responsibility. And in the Salt Lake City and in the Utah community, you are so well known for the work that you do. In fact, if anyone follows you on social media, you're not really talking about the company's successes. You're talking about the company's impact that you're having in various parts of the world and on people. So you're obviously a student in corporate social responsibility, social impact. You studied it in university. But can you tell me, where did this all begin? I don't mean with you. I mean the movement to CSR, to corporate social responsibility, because I don't think it was really around much, or it wasn't talked about much when I started GameFace in 1995, but it's everywhere today. And if a company's not involved in it, you're really at a competitive disadvantage. So where do you think it originated? Why did it bubble up, and why is it so prominent today?
Yeah, CSR is interesting because it's relatively new. It really kind of first started being talked about in the 1960s, but it wasn't until the 80s and the 90s where it really started to get a little bit more traction. And then I'd say in the last 10 years, it's become something that everyone is thinking about. The interesting thing is that in 1820, 200 years ago, 94% of the world's population was living in extreme poverty. That's under $1.90 a day in today's terms. And really the whole of human history was like this. Most of humanity has lived in extreme poverty, dealing with hunger and not having shelter or other challenges, for thousands and thousands of years, right? But it wasn't until very recently where that all started changing. When I was born in 1978, that number had dropped from 94% in 1820 to 40%. When I graduated from high school, it was 20%. Last year, it was less than 10%, like 8.5% or 9% of the world lived in extreme poverty. Like, we are eradicating extreme poverty, and we can do this in our lifetimes. It's really remarkable. But what we're learning is that that cannot happen just through government and nonprofits alone. We need businesses to think differently about the way they operate. And so even in the time of my grandparents, there were children working in factories, 7 days a week. That no longer happens. And at the same time, like our businesses today, in an effort to maximize shareholder value, to maximize profit, have destroyed our planet. If you travel much, you'll see rivers, especially in Southeast Asia or Latin America, or kind of really wherever you go in the world, that they're just filled with garbage we pollute horribly, plastics all over the ocean. And, we see that people are exploited, in different parts of the world in order to maximize profits. And this is what we're all starting to realize. We each have a responsibility to play and a role to play in making this world better. And so originally, corporate social responsibility was more geared around, hey, we have all these profits and, maybe we should try to give back a little bit. And maybe, but some of it was around risk management. It was like, hey, we need to protect our brand, and maybe we're doing some things that people might criticize us for. So if we go do some good, it might offset some of that. So there's some risk management decisions there. Some of it is around philanthropy. And I think increasingly businesses are starting to see this as a strategic advantage. It's like, hey, I think this is where the shift is happening. Like, I think what Cotopaxi is doing, I wouldn't even categorize it as corporate social responsibility. It's really, we're a benefit corporation. Which is a new type of entity. It's a for-profit business, but where you make legal commitments to use your business to do good in the world. And so for us, what I'm most proud of is not how big we are or how many employees we have or how much money we've raised. It's all about the impact that we're having. And so I think that's this movement that we're starting to see. And what we know is that, especially with these younger generations, when they see a brand that shares their values, they want to support them. And so if you build a brand that has these aligned values with the community, then it's amazing the impact it can have on the business. And then you're not making a decision between, hey, do I have to trade off doing good versus making money or being profitable? Should we use our profits in this way? For us, it's a no-brainer. It's like, that's why we exist. That's why everyone wants to support our brand. And this is our passion anyways, of course we're going to continue to do good. And in return, our community is going to come support us.
So without disparaging past generations, it sounds like if you want to be a part of Cotopaxi as a board member, for example, as a shareholder, if you will, you can't just look at ROI. To be a benefit organization, that just... it just flips everything, doesn't it, as far as how you look at the bottom line. So how are you balancing the two and still running an effective, productive, profitable business?
Yeah. You know, so, you know, first of all, when we started the business, I had to find the right investors, right? If I found the wrong investor that was so focused on profit that they weren't willing to make some longer term investments in a brand that was built around this mission, it wouldn't have gone so well. But we, you know, when I went and pitched this idea in Silicon Valley to investors, the first thing I led with was the story, was the impact, the mission. And it was pretty, you know, that would, some people, it was very clear from the beginning, they didn't really care about that. And so I knew that those were not the right investors, you know, for me. And so that was a big part of it, is like rallying the right backers, financial backers. Then it was also getting the right team, you know, people that joined our team, they joined our team because of the purpose. You know, a lot of them left big companies, you know, Nike and New Balance and, you know, Patagonia and other great brands. They made more money, some, you know, living in a really big city, and they moved to Salt Lake. And, but they came because they believed in the purpose. And so those things, when we all were aligned around why we needed to do this, it made the decisions a lot easier around, hey, you know, where do we invest our money? You know, we hired a chief impact officer in the business before we hired a chief marketing officer. We didn't even have a marketing team, but we invested in an impact officer that would help set our impact strategy, that could help us figure out how to talk about our mission and how to have the most impact with every dollar that we were giving. And so those were tough decisions. You know, the board even questioned, like, are you sure you want to hire this person before a marketer? But it was so core to who we were, it made sense, and it ended up being a good decision.
So again, I think if I looked at your business from a historical lens, just traditional business, I might say, well, wait a minute. It seems to me like perhaps you are devoting too much employee resources, employee time into social causes and not enough into actually growing the business. It's like... your do good is turning into being a do-gooder. And if I came to you with that type of statement or argument, I think you'd shoot it down pretty quickly, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would. I would. You know, it's interesting. Like, one of the greatest benefits that I've seen from having this mission, from being a benefit corporation, which I never expected, was the fact that we've been able to attract and retain talent in a way that we never would have otherwise. And, you know, we'll oftentimes have 500 or 600 applicants for a job opening. And these are not just like millennials. You know, a lot of them are young Gen Z or millennials that are saying, hey, I will come sweep the floor. I want to come be part of what you're doing. But we have people that are in the tail end of their career saying, you know what, I've made enough in my life. I want to finish my career doing something I'm really proud of. I want to go do something that really matters to me, where I can go make a difference. And so it's like, this spans across every generation. This desire to be part of something bigger. And so, you know, we've never had a problem where, and same with our customers. The customers, like, they gravitate and they evangelize our brand because of what we stand for, because of the good that we do. And they go support us. They buy our products because of that. Because when they wear, you know, a Cotopaxi backpack or fanny pack, or they're wearing one of our jackets, like, it symbolizes, like, what they stand for. They can express that outwardly. And so, yeah, we've never had a problem where we've had, you know, our employees doing out, you know, volunteering too much time in the community. We have something we call 10% in the wild time, where you can spend 10% of your work week in the wild. And it might be, you know, on a powder day going skiing, or, you know, going on a hike with your kids on a Friday afternoon. A lot of it, we also allow people to use that time to go volunteer in the community. So I spent a lot of time working with the International Rescue Committee, the IRC, that works with refugees. And, we kind of allocate some time that allow people to do that during their work week. But we've never, not once, had an issue where we've had to come to an employee and say, hey, you're spending too much time doing good and not enough time doing your job. People want to do a good job, but when you give them kind of a space to do both, they tend to find ways to balance it well.
Well, it goes back to what you said earlier. We as a human race have a tendency to want to do good, to help other people. And there are always exceptions. You've seen them in your business. I probably have seen them in mine, where people might take advantage of your what appears to be your overly generous policies as a company. But for the most part, people are conscientious. They recognize that the business has to continue to be successful. Otherwise, they don't have the job where they can perform good and do good in the community and around the globe. Speaking of around the globe, if I can go back to something you said earlier about the world and the environment. You gave a TED Talk one time where you said that nothing has damaged the planet more than capitalism. You're a capitalist, if I understand the term. So what did you mean by that?
Yeah. So I love doing survival trips. A couple times a year, I'll go off to some remote island or jungle, and I'll bring no food, and I'll survive for a week. I'll spearfish and eat coconuts and things like that. There was a couple of years ago, maybe three years ago or so, that I did one of these. And I was on this remote beach in the middle of nowhere. I didn't see a soul. I saw no boats, nothing, no airplanes. It was just like this part of the world. It was just like I was alone.
Did you see Tom Hanks by chance?
Yeah. I saw Wilson floating around the ocean. So. The one thing that just shocked me was this beach was covered in plastics for 100 miles. There were flip-flops and toothbrushes and dog toys and bottle caps and plastic containers everywhere. Like not just a few, like thousands of them over like a few hundred feet. Like you could just, if you stood in one place, you could reach down and just pick up pieces of plastic everywhere. And it's devastating. And you know, this has all happened during my lifetime, really. In the last 40 years, like 100 years ago, we weren't manufacturing plastics like this. You look at rivers, and you, like when I lived in Brazil before moving here, there was this river that I'd cross every single day to go to work. And it's just a slow moving black sludge. And I saw some pictures of it in like the late 1800s or early 1900s. It was this beautiful, like tropical looking river. And it is just so sad to see what we have done to our planet. And capitalism, it has lifted billions of people out of poverty. It's amazing what it has done to help people while also leaving our planet in a place that's almost unrecoverable. And we need to think differently about what capitalism means. And we can still believe in the principles of capitalism. We can still, look at, supply and demand. We can look at making profits, and we can look at, opening up markets and specializing in things that, each country can specialize in things that they're really good at. And, have global trade. Like these, I believe in all these principles and these concepts, but we have to think a little bit differently around our purpose. Do we really need to maximize every single dollar to try to make ourselves as rich as possible? Or can we use these, can we use our businesses to enrich the lives of people that work for us, to enrich our communities, and to help lift people that are left behind? I think capitalism is going to change in major ways over the rest of our lifetimes. And I know it because I see these young people, and they are driven by this. They care about it deeply. And I hope that they can look at us and say, wow, like this is a great example of someone that's doing something different. And they're going to see some mistakes that we make. And my hope is that they can look at us and they can do something even better, something that's even more impactful. But that's my hope, is that we can build something that can inspire this next generation to maybe look at capitalism a little bit differently.
Well, it's interesting to me that you have a mission to assist communities and nations, especially those that have historically lived in poverty, But as you said, we're down to under 10% worldwide now. And yet you are a Salt Lake City, Utah-based company based in the U.S. And so we are a predominantly capitalistic country. We could put aside politics and ideology, but I think anyone would admit that capitalism has driven this country to the success that we enjoy today and that we've enjoyed for now centuries. And you mentioned earlier that capitalism has lifted people out of poverty. So how do I balance that, Davis, that capitalism has done all of these bad things to the planet, and yet capitalism, we reside in the most capitalistic country on earth in order to produce the good that we can export to poverty-stricken countries?
You know, it's a really nice question, and I think we can look at the same, maybe a different situation, but a very similar question, which is around, you know, some of the deep questions we're asking ourselves as a country around race right now. We can look at our past and say, this is broken. Something's wrong with what we've done. So we can just take the whole thing and just say, you know what? This whole thing is not worth keeping. Let's just burn it all down. Like nothing is worth salvaging. Or we can look back and say, wow, like this country was founded on a perfect idea. And it was just implemented imperfectly by imperfect people. And the reality is that is going to happen. And we can instead look and say, wow, this perfect idea, we have made progress, but we have a long way to go. How do we make this more perfect? What can I do in my life and in my community to help make this idea, this perfect idea, more perfect? And I'd say the same with capitalism. We can either burn it all down and say, wow, it hasn't been perfect, or we can look at it and say, wow, there have been some really great things that have come from this. There's also been some real damage. And there's some things that we did wrong that have been very, very hurtful to our planet, that have left people behind. And like, what can we do differently moving forward? And so that's the approach I always like to take.
In the countries where you're doing work, where you're making contributions, you have an opportunity to teach them from the ground level what capitalism should mean, right? You can train them up in better practices of capitalism, learning from the mistakes that we have made perhaps in our country. How does that look when you go and you work in these other countries and you're helping entrepreneurs and so forth? How do you begin to teach them the better way of utilizing capitalism to get what they want without destroying something in their wake?
Yeah, maybe a couple examples. One would be, through our supply chain. We manufacture all of our backpacks in the Philippines, this amazing factory. If anyone's ever been to the Philippines, you love it. I mean, it's just like the kindest people in the world. My wife is actually half Filipina, so she grew up and was born and raised in Seattle, but I've got a special connection to the Filipino people. And I love going to this factory. It's a place where the average sewer has been there 11 and a half years. They get paid well. They listen to 80s music all day long, which is my favorite. It's just a great place. They have a volleyball and basketball club, and they're just a very active community, a team. But one of the problems that we saw there was a massive amount of waste. All the other brands that use this factory, the brands that we all know of in the outdoor industry, that if you think of any outdoor brands, they are likely using this factory as well. Tons of waste in the cutting and sewing of fabrics. And so we went to the sewers and we said, we want to do something different. We want to try something, an experiment, which is we want to use all this remnant material, this excess material. But we also see a problem that you guys are the talent. You're the artisans, the craftsmen behind this product, but you never get to choose what you sew. You never get to be creative in what you're building and creating. And so we gave them the power to use the remnant material and to design the bags themselves. We have certain profiles that they follow, but they can choose any color, any material they want. And with only one rule, to make every bag one of a kind, unique. No bag can be alike. And so it's been a really fun project. And I think these teams are seeing, wow, there's a company that cares about all this waste. Instead of it just going to a landfill or being burned, we can find ways to use this. And so I think showing throughout your entire supply chain that you can do things differently and better. And I think that can inspire, you know, thousands of people throughout your supply chains and the way that they think. Because a lot of these people, they might spend their whole life in a factory, but you know, a lot of factory owners, they spent time, or leaders in factories, they spent time on the ground floor. And so they might think differently about this moving forward. Another quick example is, I've shared this story hundreds of times, and I'm not going to go into the whole story, but there's an example that I've learned just recently of kind of the answers to your question. When I was in my early 20s, I was in college, and I did an internship in Peru. I met a little boy, a shoe shining boy named Edgar. And I'd find him every single day. It was the highlight of my day every day, finding this little kid. And I'd bring him food. And my last night in Cusco, in the city of Peru, I found him sleeping on the street close to midnight. Someone had stolen his shoe shining kit. He was too afraid to go home. He helped support his family. He wasn't in school. And you know, this boy has been in my mind every single day since 2001 when I met him. And he was an inspiration to me. When I left Cusco, I made a commitment that I was gonna use my life to help kids like Edgar. A few years ago, after starting Cotopaxi, I went back to Peru, and I'd never been back, but I wanted to go back and I wanted to try to find this boy who would now be a man. I didn't know his last name. I had one picture of him and one little short video clip of him running next to the bus, waving goodbye to me as I left Cusco. And through a series of small miracles, I found him. And it was like unbelievable. It was like one of the most beautiful moments of my life. We spent an entire day together. He showed me this, he wanted to show me his home that he'd built himself. And as we went up the hills of Cusco to go to this little house, took a little bus and then walked up the side of this mountain to get to his home. He told me his life story, that he'd been orphaned when he was 13. His mom died when he was 11, giving birth to his younger brother, and his dad died of alcohol abuse a couple of years later. He raised his younger siblings, and we got to this house, and it was a house made of mud, and it had a hole in the ground for the toilet. And there was a part of me that was so discouraged to see how he was living, but there's other part of me that was just so proud to see what he'd built himself. He was so proud of it. And we talked about what his dreams were, and he didn't have a chance to start school until he was a teenager. And so he didn't have a deep education, but he'd always dreamed of being a tour guide. And so we found a program, a 3-year program where he's graduates this year. That's been put on hold because of COVID, but where he's going to be an official tour guide. Well, he reached out to me a month ago and said, on Facebook, we're in touch pretty frequently. And he said, Davis, I am in trouble. I am in a desperate situation. I don't know what to do. My school's been shut down. I can't become an official tour guide. He still sells paintings in the street to make money. And there's no tourists. There's no one to buy anything. You know, Peru's in lockdown. He has no safety net. He has no bank account with a bunch of money in it that will hold him over for 6 months. And he has no way to feed his family, his younger siblings that he's still raising, and now his own child that he has. And, that night I was just so conflicted about what to do. And I didn't want to be in a situation where I was just sending him money anytime, you know, he needed it. But I needed to find a way that he could lift himself. But I wasn't sure how to even do that. So that night I went to bed. I was so worried about it, I could hardly sleep. And like at 5 a.m, I had this idea, which was I woke up and it was clear as day. I knew what he needed to do. And we created a walk. We started through my social network. I started selling an Edgar walking tour of Cusco, a 30-minute walking tour, virtual walking tour, and for $10. And we ended up selling $10,000 worth of walking tours for Edgar. And, last week when I was talking to him, I've been helping coach him around how to create a business and how to, use this money wisely and some of these other things. And he was telling me that his hope is to build a business where he can help other people in his community. And he was talking about how his business, he wanted to do it. And I hadn't even talked to him about Cotopaxi. He's just followed me on social media. I literally have never said, hey, let me tell you about Cotopaxi. I was shocked he even really knew about it, to be honest. And he said, I want to build a business like Cotopaxi that's helping other people. And I've never heard that in Latin America. Like, that's a new concept. Like, all my years living in Latin America, I never saw a business that had a deep social impact or that had a social mission. But this young man, as he's thinking about building a business, he's thinking about this, about how he can build a business in a better way through, you know, through responsible capitalism.
That's a marvelous story. I appreciate you sharing that. And one of the things that I've learned, and this I think it just reinforces what you just taught us about Edgar, is that when we have this notion to do good in a foreign country, and we take our goods there, you know, and we ship clothing or other commodities, it feels good to do that. And we're certainly fulfilling an immediate need within the population. But the thing that I've learned is that at the same time, we could be undermining local entrepreneurs, local businesses that are trying to survive, because we're actually infiltrating their market. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing for members of a wealthy population or country such as the United States, Canada, et cetera, to do that, to ship commodities elsewhere. But I think we have to have a more 360 view of what impact that is having. So I'm sure you've run up against that, but you just told us an example, shared with us an example of how you didn't go basically say to Edgar, get out of the way, I know exactly what you need. And instead you taught him to fish, right? And he's learned from your example. So am I crazy in what I've just suggested for our audience?
No, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I think there's so many unintended consequences of decisions that we make, and a lot of times with good intentions. You know, I think one great example is Tom's Shoes, right? It's and Blake, the founder of Tom's, is an investor of ours. He's a friend. He's someone I admire a lot. But he'd be the first to tell you that when they first started, they didn't realize that they were creating a problem. They were donating a shoe for every shoe they sold. They were going to these markets and they were disrupting local shoe markets. And like, so local salesmen or shoe repair people lost work because they were getting, everyone in the market was getting free shoes. And so they had to adapt and change their giving strategy. And that's with Cotopaxi, we learned from that example. And so we don't have a buy one, give one model. We don't give a backpack away for every backpack we sell. We instead focus on three core pillars that we believe are inextricably linked to poverty alleviation, which is education, healthcare, and livelihood training. And with a focus on those three things, we allow people to really kind of lift themselves out of poverty, where they have the tools and the resources to be able to do that. So you're right. Lots of lessons learning. And I'm sure, again, we're probably making some mistakes now. And we hope to learn from those quickly and allow others to learn from us so they can do it even better than us in the future.
Well, Davis, as we wrap up this interview, let's do a little rapid fire, as some people call it. Can we? So we'll do some word association. I'm gonna say a word, and I'd like you to tell us a company or an organization that you think embodies this word. Now you can't use Cotopaxi, okay? The first word is innovation. Which company comes to mind?
Apple. Do you want me to talk about it, or?
Yeah, briefly, if you would.
Oh, just, what I love about Apple is that they realized what consumers wanted when consumers didn't even realize they wanted it. Like, digital music. They weren't the first ones to invent digital music that existed, but they created this, you know, this iPod, you know, or the iPhone, the touch screen. It's like, I had a BlackBerry. I didn't feel like I even needed the touch screen. It's like, I've got this keyboard that works great. And now I can't imagine going back to my old BlackBerry. So I just love the way that they had foresight and courage to develop product that they believed solved a problem that most of us didn't even realize we had.
Next word, image.
Patagonia. Yvon Chouinard, the founder, you know, this company is close to 50 years old. He knew what that business was going to stand for from the very beginning. No one was thinking about protecting the environment back when he was thinking about this. And they've stayed so true to that, that the image when you see the Patagonia logo, you know, you know exactly what they stand for. You know their values. And so I think they've just done an amazing job of protecting this image and creating a vision for what they stand for over decades. And they've never deviated from that.
Let's do one more. Employee engagement.
Employee engagement. Yeah, this is a good one. I'd maybe say Warby Parker. Warby Parker is an eyewear company. In fact, I'm wearing Warby Parkers right now. They were started by some classmates of mine in business school. And I love the way that Dave and Neil, the co-CEOs, lead that business and the way that they listen to their team. They have north of 100 retail stores around the country. And I love the way that they engage with their team. I've seen it internally and externally, like even on their social media, you'll see that they're taking feedback from a lot of people are commenting saying, hey, I'm, you know, we're talking about race. You know, they're saying, hey, I work in one of your retail stores. This is what I'm seeing. They're like engaging on a public forum with their team around ways that they can improve. And it's very clear that these teams feel safe. They feel safe communicating the good and the bad and the ugly of things that can be done and improved. So I really love the way that they engage with their team. And if you go visit a store, it's unlike any experience I've had in a retail environment. Like their team is passionate about what they do. The service level is like next level. And that only happens when you have a team that feels engaged and connected to.
Awesome. Thank you for that. So last question for you, Davis. And I know that it's clear, it's evident, both through this conversation and just everything that you're involved in, that Cotopaxi is like a child of yours, right? You're so wedded to it, and it is you, and you are it. Is there anything that you would have accomplished or achieved in Cotopaxi that would finally convince you it's time to move on? It's time to do something else. What's the ultimate goal that you would like to see achieved where you can say, my work is done here?
I don't know that will ever happen. But the day that we can say we've eradicated extreme poverty, which I believe really will happen in my lifetime, that will be a special day. And if there was ever a time where it's like, my job is done, that may be it. But even then, there will still be enormous amounts of suffering. And even when you eradicate extreme poverty, there's still poverty. There's still people living on less than, you know, $3 or $4 a day that are going to need help, right? So this is a work that probably will never end. And it's hard for me to imagine anything that I'd be more passionate about than this. And so after my first few businesses, I was always anxious for the next project, the next thing, the next learning, the next big idea. I just don't feel that. Those feelings have gone away from me. This is my life's passion. I hope I can dedicate my whole life to it.
Well, thank you, Davis. I think your coworkers are lucky to have you. And I know you'd say you're lucky to have them. The people who benefit from your product and from your largesse are lucky to have you. Salt Lake City, since you moved to Salt Lake City from Brazil, they're certainly lucky to have you and the world of entrepreneurship and philanthropy. So I want to thank you for everything you're doing, everything you will do. Thank you for leading out. Thank you for being a real game changer in your space. And your space is growing rapidly. So I appreciate you joining us today on Game Face Execs.
Thanks, Rob. Really, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being a part of this episode of Game Face Execs. If you found any of it useful or helpful, please rate or like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. I always appreciate you referring us to others as well. I'll see you next week. Until then, persuade, influence, inspire.